Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. At 32, today's guest, Amy Boesky, thought she had it all figured out, a wonderful new man in her life, a great job, and the nearly perfect home. For once, she was almost able to shake the terrible fear that had gripped her for so long as she could remember. Women in her family had always died young from cancer, and she and her sisters had grown up in time's shadow. It colored every choice they made and was beginning to come to a head now that each of them approached 35, the deadline their doctors prescribed for having preventive surgery with the hope that they could thwart their family's medical curse. But Amy didn't want to dwell on that now. She wanted to plan for a new baby, live her life, and with the appreciation for life's smallest pleasures, she did just that. In What We Have, Amy shares a deeply transformative year in her family's life and invites readers to join in their joy, laughter, and grief. A graduate of Oxford and Harvard, Amy Boesky is an associate professor of English at Boston College. She was one of the principal ghostwriters for the best-selling young adult series, Sweet Valley High. Amy, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad to have you on the show, Amy. I loved your book. I was glued to it. My husband couldn't get me off the couch. I'm reading. And, you know, it's funny because there's some serious topics, obviously, but you have some really good humor in the book as well, which we will get to. Yes. And in the prologue to your book, What We Have, you write, quote, "It isn't really a cancer story or survivor story, though it has cancer surviving in it. Instead, it's a pre-vivor story." Amy, what is a pre-vivor?
A pre-vivor, it's interesting. Pre-vivor is a new word. It was coined in 2000, actually by Sue Friedman, who's the executive director and founder of FORCE. And she and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago, and she told me that she and a colleague came up with a word in response to a woman on a message board who said, "I need a word for what I am." And the word, which I think is a wonderful word, has something of survivor in it, but of course it's got that pre, that, you know, that sort of pre that suggests the not yet, which is so much what this new word is filled with. It points to the future, to the foreshortened future, to the possibilities that we fear, and the sense that maybe there's something we can do to fight those.
Yes, you know, and in the book, you know, you talk a lot about your fear and about, a lot about time and your relationship with time and the work that you do. And you write, quote, "I had a timeline. In my family, it was all mapped out. Around age 6 or 7, you got glasses. Around 18 or 19, your wisdom teeth came out. And by age 35, it was time to take out your ovaries." When did your parents, I don't know if it was your mother, father, or both, sit you down and let you know that this was something that was in the family?
That's a wonderful question. I don't know there was ever a moment. It was the air we breathed. I write in the book about the experience of walking up and down the hallway and looking at those photographs that were, for me, I think I described it as a sort of ill-fated family tree. They were all women, and some of them are on the book cover. I think that we knew that the single shaping event in my mother's life was the death of her mother, Sylvia, when my mother was only 19. She had just finished her freshman year of college, and she came home for the summer to Chicago. She was a freshman at University of Michigan. She came home, and her parents were divorced, and her father was really pretty checked out and let the doctors tell her that her mother only had a few months left to live, and in fact, she only made it through that summer. Mm-hmm. And that was so formative for my mother, who a few months later, she and my father got married. She was a sophomore in college. She studied psychology and eventually history. But it so shaped who she was and how she thought about love and life that I think there was no time that we didn't somehow know this.
Yes. And how was that for you? I mean, how did that feel for you growing up and for your sisters, Sarah and Julie?
It was really hard, and it was also so woven into the texture of who we are and how we think and act as a family that I think, like many families, if you think about the sort of warp and weave of what makes up the difficult and challenging and also wonderful things about who you are, it's remarkable how much sometimes the hardest things are also the best things. And there was a sort of steely thread that ran through this tapestry, and my mother's resolve and passion for life and intelligence and wit was as much a part of her as her anxiety and need to plan and wanting to know the next chapter before that one was finished. We always have a joke in my family that, you know, you can tell a Boesky because they're planning where they're going to eat the next night when they've barely picked up their fork for the first meal. And it's really true. It's still that way. I don't know whether, you know, does that come from my father's side of the family who has none of this? Does it come from my mother's? But it was hard. And honestly, it's something that Jacques and I talk a lot about because, of course, I think now as much as a mother, as a daughter, and when I think about my own daughters and how I want them to live, we both, Jacques and I, feel very strongly that we want them to have some space of time in which they can be as unimpacted by this as possible. Now, of course, they read my book and helped me with chapters, and they, you know, were deep in various parts and, you know, sort of proofreading and saying, now, Mom, how do you, is mastectomy with, you know, two T's? Or, you know, so they're deep in this at 16 and 18. But they weren't at 6 and 8. You know, they were, I hope, as much as possible to have been able, and part of the reason I wanted to write the book is to think about reaching out to the next generation to sort of say, how can we do it better for you guys? How can you have more resources, more support, more conversations? For me, you know, honestly, it was lonely. There wasn't yet force. There wasn't yet communities of women who get together and are willing. I mean, it's so extraordinary. Now women can share so much on message boards. They can show each other what they look like after surgery. They can take the fear and the sting out of some of this by, with humor and goodwill and information. What did you think of that plastic surgeon? Would you have done this differently? You know, what do you do if you haven't had your children yet and you've, or you're not done with your family yet and you've tested positive? You know, women can share so much now. It was lonelier for me. I remember a wonderful woman who was at the time in her 50s, I was in my 30s when I had my surgery done, met me in the lingerie department at Bloomingdale's and, you know, sort of hiked up her T-shirt and showed me the results of her surgery, and that was so generous and meant so much to me.
Oh, now, you had mentioned force a couple times, and for people who aren't familiar, if you can tell us about that.
Sure. FORCE stands for, it's an acronym, it stands for Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered. And it's a virtual space for previvors and survivors to share information and resources. And, again, the executive director is Sue Friedman. I found it, stumbled across it like many people do by Googling and looking for people out there who I could talk to. I've been local. I've actually been active in my local chapter. I've been more active going to meetings at people's houses than I have been on I'm not a message boarder myself. So I've been more active actually in the face-to-face because that was something that really meant a lot to me. And it was very reassuring for me, as I think it might be for perhaps for your listeners out there, to know that there's no one-size-fits-all response to this. There's no mandate to say, okay, if you have this in your family, you have to get tested. Or if you get tested and you're positive, you have to have surgery. Because it's not the same for each individual. These are immensely personal choices. And I found it really helpful to meet other women and men and to learn that there are different ways of going about this that make sense to the
individual. Yeah, and when you mentioned getting tested, you're talking about the BRCA1 and the BRCA2. And if you can tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah. And it's complicated because I've actually have been learning and writing a little bit about some of the political debates around the question of testing, and which right now is very much controlled by a company called Myriad. Right now, those are the two mutations that you can be tested for. So we all have and want to have the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes. Those are tumor suppressors. But if there's a mutation in one of those genes, they're not doing the defensive work that they need to be doing. And so we often talk about having the gene or having the breast cancer gene. But in fact, what we have, if we have this, is a mutation in one of those genes. And those mutations essentially mean a kind of breakdown in the body's defense system. We don't know, scientists, and I'm not a scientist, I'm a writer and an English professor, but from what I've learned from my doctors and from talking with people, we don't still know all the ways in which that genetic mutation intersects with other issues. Is it something in the environment? Is it something in, you know, is it something else? We don't know. You just right. know that without that strong defense, that the susceptibility to those cancers goes way, way, way up.
Well, you know, I had mentioned that my mother died of ovarian cancer. It'll be 15 years this year. And
wow.
I've been nervous to go get the test done. And I feel like I'm going to eventually, but I'm just not quite ready. It's funny, too, because even my doctor a few years ago, he said, you're anxious enough. I think I would wait.
Well, that's a really, you know, it's interesting. And I actually write about this in the book because I, too, I'm, you know, thank you for telling me that. And I'm so sorry about your mom.
Oh.
I mean, I, you know, I, too, am a person who is on the anxious side when it comes to my health.
Yes.
You know, I think that we need to know that about ourselves. And we need to know, I have a sort of, you know, a sense that if you find out, if this is in your family, that there's sort of a few things that I think it's really imperative to do.
Okay.
To get information, to seek information and to get educated, to be honest with yourself, to think about what are my feelings about risk, what do I want to live with, what can I live with, and what can the people who I love around me live with? I mean, I can tell you in a few moments, my husband and I feel differently about this, and it's been fascinating. We have a great marriage, but, you know, we debate this back and forth. He feels very differently about knowing and seeking out information than I do. Finally, I think it's really important to connect to other people and not to kind of live with this alone, whether it's your immediate – I mean, I've been so blessed because I have these two extraordinary sisters, and they went through this – the three of us have gone through this every step of the way. We had surgeries together. We all talked about it. We all sort of felt that we weren't ready. In 1994, when we got the information that our family has hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, we weren't ready yet to be tested, but we were already planning to have surgery. So we decided at that time, without a positive result in our family, the negative result wouldn't be conclusive. And we really felt we needed surgery to be able to just to live our lives. So for us, it made sense to pursue surgery without testing. But that was back in the mid-90s, and, you know, the whole terrain has changed so much now that I think women would be facing and men would be facing a different set of choices.
So you had had your ovaries taken out, or do you have a whole entire hysterectomy, and also your breasts were reconstructed, or they – what did you have?
Yeah, so I had – the first thing that happened after my mom died, I was about a month pregnant with my second daughter when my mom died.
Oh.
And about a month after Libby was born, I got this letter. And the letter was from Creighton University. They were following our family because my father, who's a doctor, had been really proactive in the 80s. And he had followed the family history. And when my mother's only cousin died of ovarian cancer, making it – at this point, it was my mother's mother, my mother's mother's sister, and my mother's only cousin. All three out of four women had died of ovarian cancer. So we were – so worried about it. My father was so worried about it that he was sending out feelers and information to Creighton and to the Gilda Radner Institute. And we got this letter. I opened the letter. I was sitting in my study, and Libby was napping, and it was as if the ground fell out from under me, because we had convinced ourselves somehow that my mother's death, which was from breast cancer, was not the same thing, that it was part of another terrible set of circumstances. It didn't make it any less painful. There isn't a day, it's been almost 17 years since my mother died, and there isn't a day where that absence isn't so present for me. I mean, I keep waiting for it to get smaller, and strangely, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. That's a whole other topic that I love to talk about.
I mean,
sometimes.
You must feel the same way. Isn't it extraordinary?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard.
And each new event, each new milestone, it's as if it's the aggregate of all those other things that she's missed and that you've missed in her, and a whole other topic. But so I opened this letter, and my sisters in their respective states, one in Maine, one in Washington State, we were fanned across the nation, got their copies of this letter, and it was like, whoa. This was the same thing. In the book, I describe it as we thought we had a sharpshooter circling around us, and now it was as if someone told us, there's two. There's one in front of you that you can see, but you know what? There's one behind you that you can't. And I had already determined that I was going to have my ovaries removed. I had more or less, as soon as Libby was born, I had my second child. It was all I dreamed of, two healthy girls. I was ready. I mean, would I have loved to have the chance for a third child? Absolutely. And in fact, my doctor asked me that when I came in to schedule the surgery. I had Libby in my arms. I sort of felt like something out of Tess and the D'Urbervilles. You know, I sort of felt like I must look so sort of dramatic to them. But I was really ready. I had lived with this all my life, and I knew I wanted the surgery. Yes, I would have loved the chance of a third child, but I wasn't going to risk. I was 34. I felt like it was time. Mm-hmm. Then we get this news, and now what? You know, I was afraid if I waited for the testing and I got inconclusive results or if I got a negative, I was afraid that my doctors would change their minds. I wasn't going to change my mind, but I was afraid my doctors would change their minds or my insurance would pull out. And so I went ahead and had the ovarian surgery. 2 years later, when I was almost 37, I had what's called prophylactic mastectomies, which is I had both my breasts removed, all the breast tissue. I said to my surgeon is a woman, and let me say, for anyone who feels that this is a sort of I don't know, that there's something about a kind of masculinist plot in this about deforming women's bodies, I said, as a woman and as a feminist, I said to my wonderful female surgeon, I want you to get every last cell. Get up under my armpit, go into my clavicle. I want every cell gone. And I still had not been tested. We didn't have a positive result in my family for many years. And without that positive result, which we eventually did get, it's actually through my cousins. But once we had that positive result, we now know we're a BRCA1 family. And now I'm in the exact same boat you're in. I'm thinking, even though I've done this surgery, I need to be tested. What do I tell my daughters? And I'm putting it off. I don't know. I'm not certain that I'm ready. And there isn't a day that I wake up and say, today's the day.
Yeah. No, I understand. And I think my doctor knows me pretty well, so I thought that was pretty good advice, actually. And that was a very stressful time in my life. I mean, that was several years ago when he said that to me. I had a lot of things going on that were stressful, and he said about the anxiety, you're anxious enough. Why don't we wait for a while?
Yeah.
But I think now he'd say, okay, things have calmed down. Why don't we – let's revisit this. But I'm still not ready. But it is. It's a hard choice. I mean, how much do you want to know? And that's what's so great about your book is you talk about that and the fear and the way it affects you. And I did mention the humor, so I want to make sure I get this in. Because honestly, there were so many times I would laugh out loud, and my husband would say, what are you reading? What's so funny? And I'd read him the line, and he would laugh. This is one of my favorites. Now, being a transplant to the Boston area from California, one of my favorite lines was, this is about when you were living in D.C., and people in D.C. were friendly, much friendlier than in Boston. Sometimes people I didn't even know said hello on purpose. That cracked me up. And then the other thing was about, for everybody, labor starts a different time. For us, it started over arguing where to park the car.
As it did. And we're still arguing about where to park the car. You know,
yeah, you guys
amazing.
Are really different, and that's what makes you and Jock is your husband. And it's just so interesting to read, and just his – you have a very different idea of kind of the way – not I don't want to say the way things are done, but how would you describe it?
Well, it's so interesting. You know, you talk about time and the way time is sort of woven through the book. I mean, I at one point talk about the fact that it's as if Jock and I live in different time zones. I mean,
yes.
He's perpetually relaxed, and he's of the lastminute.com, and I'm of the, you know,
booking the tickets to Chicago now for next August because I can get a better deal and because I love to plan, you know.
Yes, me too.
love to plan. And I don't know if it's male, female. So many of my friends and people who have read the book have told me that is like my husband or that's like my partner or he's like, you know, doesn't want to deal with this now, i.e. ever. But there is a lot of love and humor. I mean, we have a friend of mine who's a writer just wrote a wonderful piece in the Boston Globe about how marriage is a conversation. And I think marriage, when I think about Jacques and Jacques and me, it's marriage is a conversation. It's sometimes an argument. It's sometimes a debate. It's sometimes a loving series of jokes and riffs where we, you know, make fun of each other. Here's an example. I've been terrified for the last couple of weeks. We have this mouse that we've been trying to catch in our almost perfect house has a very imperfect mouse that is in the kitchen. And no matter what I do, I can't get it. And this morning I go to open the pantry and Jacques put this rubber rat.
Oh,
huge,
my goodness.
Rubber
my
rat from Halloween. He put it in the pantry and I almost had a heart attack. So that is his sense of humor at work. I mean, he knows how to lighten things up and back off and sort of say, you know, this is life. And I think that's been a huge saving thing for me. One of the things I like about the title of the book is that the we is, and this was the my wonderful editor and the fantastic designers of the book jacket put
yes,
we
I love
in,
it.
They put we in italics, and at first I looked at it and I thought, we, you know, and I think one of the things that I love about the word we is that, you know, yes, this is maybe targeted to the we that is my family and the we that is this pre-Viber community, but it's everyone. I mean, we all are dealing with these things. We're all dealing with anxiety about health. We're all dealing with mortality. We're all trying to fit love and laughter in along with the hard stuff. So I love that we. I love the slant on it because it kind of also, to my mind, almost lightens the we and makes it feel less sort of poor me and more look at all of us, you
yeah,
know, and
inclusive.
To be able to laugh at some of it, too.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you, Amy. Your book, What We Have, Our Family's Inspiring Story About Love, Loss, and Survival, is fantastic. And if you can give us your website or any other information you'd like us to have about
absolutely.
Your book. Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you. It's whatwehave.org or amybosky.com. And I really thank you for having me and thank all your listeners and just really enjoyed being on the show.
Oh, I'm so glad, and I plan on having you on It's Your Health TV, which people can watch on the site and also on My TV New England. That's going to be starting in August or September. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. I hope everyone has a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.